The land north of 25th and Michigan, just east of Woodland and west of Brooklyn, is vacant. Behind a stone wall, a whole neighborhood block is a lush green hill teeming with weeds, with an abandoned park beyond that. You can hear the faint chirping of birds and bugs, but aside from some random debris strewn about on the curb, nature has officially taken over. That's what I saw yesterday when I walked around with Daniel and Ebony Edwards, but what they see is the future they envision here. New houses, a black box theater, across the street in the boarded up cinder block daycare that Daniel's siblings went to. That's where they want to put a co-working space for creatives. This young married couple isn't parachuting into the East Side from somewhere else with cartoon dollar signs in their eyes. They're from the East Side, and their whole love story is about transforming this place, not from the outside in, from the inside out. The question is, can they do it? It's not just Kansas Cityans waiting to find out. Other people in other cities are watching, hoping they'll somehow crack the code. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Daniel and Ebony Edwards. Hi, guys.
Hello. Man, that was so good.
It was.
Gosh, thanks. I am observing right now that you are sitting here with Play-Doh, which is a first for me in an interview, I want to say. But you mentioned yesterday as we were walking around that people working on neighborhood reinvestment in other cities have told you that if you break ground, you will have cracked the code. What does that mean? You will have cracked the code for what?
So 1949, people started to leave the hood. And then soon after, bulldozers came in and urban renewal demolished all of our neighborhoods. And so nobody has figured out how to rebuild those neighborhoods. We've had a lot of talk about them. And typically when they are rebuilt, most of the people are displaced in the process of the rebuilding. So we feel like we have cracked the code of rebuilding neighborhoods demolished by urban renewal across the country by bringing ownership back.
What else is part of this code that hasn't been cracked?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, I think part of it is we need to really redefine what we mean by rebuild neighborhoods. So, you know, if you talk to us, they've talked to a lot of people that are in real estate development, you'll hear them talking about, you know, single site projects that are not really going to have a big transformative impact on a neighborhood. And they could, but not as if the real estate development that would be happening really for the entire neighborhood. So thinking about more of a holistic approach to real estate development that's going to impact people in the neighborhood. And what we hear a lot about when we think about it from that perspective is that people who are in the neighborhood are not really full participants in real estate development, not really included in the process of real estate development.
Why is that important to you that they would be included?
Well, I mean, I think from a traditional standpoint, you know, wanting to redevelop a neighborhood for the people in the neighborhood so that it includes what the people in the neighborhood want. But if we think beyond that, it's important to have, you know, I guess what's a really kind of hot topic right now is regenerative economies or inclusive economies. So to really be able to create something in a neighborhood that the people who are there can benefit from has to start with the people in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Why is that hard? What are you up against?
Well, I mean, typical developments, they start out with neighborhood engagement and all these charrettes and design things and all this stuff. But then it's still the developer at the end of the day who's making the final decisions on the back end of the deal. It's still the developer at the end of the day, as most of the developments that take place in urban core communities demolished by urban renewal are still mostly low-income housing tax projects, or they are different projects that are multifamily and rental in nature. And so at the end of the day, the buck still stops with the developer. And we've been a part of many neighborhoods and developments where the developers come in with all these huge promises. They work with the neighborhood to say, we're going to do this and we're going to give you this and you can have access to this space.
And you say you've been part of that. What do you mean?
Well, we just sold our house. We were in Mannheim. There was a project in Mannheim of the Bancroft redevelopment of the school. And there were promises of access, and I don't know if those promises were fully carried through on all the back end of it.
So, as like the resident of a neighborhood where a project swooped in, you didn't feel like...
Right. It seemed like the developer was a part of the project up until they were able to close a deal, get the bank financing, and break ground. And they were committed with the neighborhood, but then outside of that... it's really difficult to get in touch with the developers after that. And it's not just Bancroft, it's most other developments when you have a developer who's not really a part of the neighborhood and the community that they're developing in.
Then it's a business deal.
It's a business deal. It's a transaction.
So explain this project that I was just describing. There's this plot of land I just described. That's where you're planning to build houses. And do you already have people lined up wanting to move in?
We do. We have 7 families. We just had dinner with them last night, and it was so dope.
Tell me about the dinner.
So one of our families is the owner of Stockyards Brewery, Greg Bland and Meg Moore. And they opened up their space to us. We've been throwing dinner parties. We call them feast. And we have live chefs, or we have chefs that come out and cook live for us. And we've been doing it with artists and entertainers. But last night we actually were able to do it with our families that are moving into the neighborhood to give them updates and talk about everything that we had going on. So it was so good to see like young people, older people, 2 months old to, you know, 16-year-old kids all sitting in one space like, man, we, like this time next year, we'll be having these dinner parties in our backyards, you know?
You think so. Next year?
Yeah, definitely.
Wow. Ebony, talk to me about this dinner and like what you heard from people that's sort of sticking with you this morning.
I think it was that last point that Daniel made reminded me of someone saying that we're setting a very high bar for our dinner parties when we actually do move to the neighborhood, because we are having these live chefs that are a part of them now. But yeah, outside of that, it's just, you know, the ability for all of us to get together, talking about, there's the 16-year-old, the oldest of the kids that was there. We call her the sitter because she loves dogs. She loves babies. She loves to just take care of anyone who has a dog and their kids. So just looking forward to things like that, of a lot of that, like really creating that sense of community and being community for one another.
But then to make this all happen, correct me if I've misunderstood, this is maybe for the Black Box Theater that would be in what's now a park, but the land is in the shape of a hill, as I described, because at some point people just buried some old houses, right?
Right. So back in the day when they would come through in urban renewal, they would just take a bulldozer, dump the whole house into the basement, and then cover it with topsoil, and grass would grow up and trees would grow up.
Problem solved.
Yes, problem solved. Until 70 years later, you have a group of families who want to move back who have to then pay for that. Somebody has to pay for it.
You have to dig it up, basically, right?
Yeah, we have to go back in, dig up everything. They stuck a pole 2 feet underground and we hit foundations. And so we have to go back in, dig all that up, start back over. And when we think about affordability in Kansas City, when families who can only afford a $150,000 home or a $130,000 home or a school teacher or whatever it might be, they can't afford to add $60,000 or $70,000 extra onto their home budget in order to start over. So that's really the big challenge of what we ran into, or what we've been running into, or what we've dug into, I guess you could say.
So, yeah, I mean, there's also this boarded up daycare I mentioned. It used to be a place called Lollipop Land.
Lollipop Land.
So cheerful. It is currently it's both charming and a little bit creepy because it's abandoned and there are like things that you would not expect to see at a functioning playground. But I understand. Yeah. Okay, so Daniel, your siblings went there, right?
Yeah, they did.
And then you mentioned on social media, hey, we're thinking of doing something with the old Lollipop Land, and tons of alums were like, no, leave it alone.
Yeah, they were like, we need another daycare. Turn it back into a daycare. And I'm like, guys, I really care, and I know what you want to do, but I'm like, well, can we like push the boundaries on just daycare alone and move it to like youth development or like creativity development or something like that? So, but yeah, my brother and sister went there when I was a little kid. So,
can you guys talk about seeing the building and starting to have these ideas about it? Like, not everyone would see a structure like this and want to take it on.
Yeah, not everybody would get married in an old abandoned prison either.
Oh, we're getting there. Yeah, tell me about these, like, I mean, what I envision as like dinner table conversations where you're like, want to fix a block-long building that's been sitting empty for about a decade, maybe more? Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that that's been a learning process.
I wonder how Ebony explains this, because me, I'm like, I see it. Let's go.
Exactly. Yeah. Daniel's definitely the visionary.
You more nuts and bolts?
Oh, absolutely. Nuts and bolts. How are we going to get it done? Okay, that's great, but let's like strategize about this, right? But through the course of our relationship and finding these projects that no one else has taken on, right? Well, not even like could say no one would take on, but they just haven't, right? It's taken me some time to really like catch up to that level of vision. But from a practical standpoint, I mean, it really does make sense, because we're talking about a block where we have a plan to move 50 families onto this block that you spoke about earlier. And then we just have an abandoned building that's right across the street, which is actually in the middle of a community, right?
An existing on the other, just north of 25th and Michigan, to both the east and the west of this abandoned daycare, there are homes with people living in them, well-maintained.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. And so, I mean, you know, to come in and to, it's one thing to come in and to build homes for families to re-inhabit a neighborhood, right? But then to go in and to look at the existing infrastructure that has the potential to cater to more than just families that are moving into a neighborhood, but the families that are existing in the neighborhood.
Well, and also this thing that you're trying to build, if there's a big abandoned building that takes up a whole block to the north of it, that's not exactly a selling point.
No, it's not at all. It's not a selling point at all. And Ms. Smith, who lives across the street, she was like, when are y'all gonna get to work? And I'm like, I know, we coming. Like, it's coming.
It's interesting to me, as I spend some time talking to you, that right now, most of what you're doing is going to meetings, like before you can even do the physical work.
Yeah, it's meetings and emails. The fact is that this is real money, and it's real lives as well. And you have to be very sensitive and maybe a better word. Sensitive is a good word, but I think you have to be a good steward of both. And that requires a lot more foundational groundwork. So that way, when we do break ground and we do start to move forward to make our progress, that everybody is aware of the plan and the strategy, and we're all working in collaboration together, as opposed to we just got this random idea and we're just going to go start this and just get going. And
the meetings. What kinds of people are your meetings with?
From that perspective, it's a lot of people who are interested in what we're doing, right? I mean, everyone from people who are currently moving into the neighborhood or have plans to people who are interested in or just want to learn more about what we're doing. And then we have a lot of meetings with actual, like, performing artists.
We haven't addressed that what you want to turn that space, that daycare space, into is a performing arts co-working space.
Yeah, that's right. And so,
with studios where people can record, things like that.
That's right.
Rehearsal spaces.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, we hear it at this point every week that performing artists and probably broader than that, actually, are just hurting for space. They need space. They need space that they can afford to be in. From the performing artist's perspective, they need spaces where they can practice, where they can rehearse, where they can store their equipment and things like that. We have meetings with people who are at theater companies, with actual just musicians, producers as well.
And also school board representatives
So that makes us more, I think that's where Ebony and I, our strength has gained over the last several years, is we've had to be fluent in not only the performing arts and entertainment and the needs of the programming needs on the ground, but the more technical needs of city planning department, planning and zoning, neighborhood housing services, lawyers, attorneys, EDC, LCRA, EEZ. So all these people. Mm-hmm.
Is it daunting to hear that if you so much as stick a shovel in the ground, you will have gotten further than other people have in other cities trying to do similar things? I mean, there's still a lot to do after you stick a shovel in the ground.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have stuck shovels into a ground. You know, there are a lot of shovels. There's even shovels that are going into the ground on the east side. I think the big difference about the shovels that we are putting there is more of, they're shovels by I mean, we're millennials, we're young, we're African American, we got two little girls that are 1 and 3, and it's shovels being put in the ground by people who actually want to be in the neighborhoods and move there. It's not shovels being put in the ground by outside, and it's nothing wrong with outside developers. But I mean, now that we are moving to the block that we're actually developing and then expanding that programming or expanding that development out, I think this could be one of the first developments for millennials, not necessarily for millennials, but by millennials, with
your like worldview in mind,
Yeah, it's our worldview. And I think that's really shifted a lot in Kansas City recently. And we just need that worldview needs a home to locate itself in right now in Kansas City.
Can you describe for me the sort of fantasy, the daydream of when you picture your home in this neighborhood and the neighborhood is what you want it to be? Describe your life there for me. Describe your home. Describe it. Walk, take me on that walk.
We always talk about living in a neighborhood where, you know, like our kids are just kind of out and free. Like they're free to just be themselves and to roam and to go between houses. We know everyone who's there on the block. We all know and trust, love, care each other, and pour the same amount of attention and care that we would into our own selves, our own families, into the families that live on the block with us, right? So it's definitely like that, more of a kind of communal vibe where everyone is just kind of coexisting together. But in addition to that, definitely like to be an inspiration to people who are just visiting the neighborhood. So, you know, eventually one day we'll get there where we have amenities, resources, restaurants, for example, where people are actually in the neighborhood to just visit the neighborhood, but like are inspired by the beginning stages and what the families who kind of saw this vision through at the beginning and then moved into the neighborhood with us have been able to create. Because it's been all of us together.
And I'm also trying to push the boundaries. Like I'm a big dreamer. And I have seen how the built space is cared for and curated in other parts of our city. And it's not cared for and curated in the east side. And so I really want to create like a place where the sidewalks light up when you walk up the street and where you could speak into a tree and you can hear somebody else talking to you from 6 blocks away. And there are shared dinner tables across the neighborhood in shipping container pods where people can just go make their food and just go sit in a container and just have dinner with neighbors.
Some communal space.
Yeah, like spaces that are specifically designed to say, hey, we care and we need to spend time with you. We have a big retaining wall outside of our homes and with Stockyards Brewery being there and the owners of Thou Mayest Coffee being there. We were just saying, like, what if we ran beer taps out of the retaining wall? And so put in a key code and you can walk up the street and just like grab some coffee or grab some hot chocolate or...
This is totally the millennial dream.
I know, right? But I mean, it's actually, we've even talked about our HOA, and as opposed to the HOA being...
What does that stand for?
Homeowners Association Fee. So instead of our HOA being designed around, obviously we want to take care of grass and it really be a plug and play type neighborhood where people could just move in and really opt out of services. But our fees are going to like, how do we get like a field trip bus for our kids? And how do we get like a party bus for our adults? And so really start to think about different ways of being in a community and being a community.
Can we back up? I want to hear your stories to get a clear sense of what it is that motivates you and drives all of this. Ebony, I want to start with you. You grew up in houses like around 63rd and Truce, 63rd and Paseo.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd you go to school? What was your childhood like?
Yeah, so I actually, I went to private school from kindergarten to eighth grade, just right nearby my neighborhood at St. Peter's, and then I went to high school at Hogan Prep, which is about 2 blocks away, which is a public charter school. And, you know, that was really the first time that I really noticed that there were such stark differences in our city.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, just, you know, at that point in time, and of course, this has expanded since then, but just to really see that the education expectations were just so drastically different.
From where you had been.
Yeah, exactly. Going into ninth grade, I mean, I was, you know, learning at that stage things I had learned so much younger at my previous school. And, you know, at that point was really affected by it and just kind of over time continued to be like really impacted by that. The fact that I lived that experience and I could just look around me and see, you know, how, you know, really literally kids being left behind because of this stark difference in opportunity and access to opportunities, which always makes me really emotional. Sorry, but
no, I mean, of course, because it's not just words. Those are people that you're remembering.
Yeah. I mean, it's the truth. It really is the core for me, the core of doing this work of rebuilding neighborhoods, because, you know, unfortunately, when we talk about access to opportunities, it is a zip code issue. It's our cities are disproportionately resourced. You know, those kind of, you know, lower, I guess, levels of opportunity exist in neighborhoods that do have a lot of vacancy, a lot of, you know, blight, and just not enough people there to really power and support resources that are needed for our kids to really, you know, have the equity and those kinds of opportunities.
You eventually went to a historically Black college.
I did.
Was that a choice that was influenced by these kinds of thoughts, or was it just sort of like a gut feeling that that's where you would thrive?
Yeah, I guess so. I just, you know, I was, my private school was a majority white school. I was probably one of a couple kids there that was a minority. And I went to high school and just like I started going to a really prominent Black church here. And which really, and actually the kind of, there was a lot of, you know, I guess discussion and like, exposure to Black culture at the church that I went to. And so I started seeing a lot of HBCUs and felt like I really wanted to experience that part of my background.
What was it like? How did that experience
amazing
shape you?
It was amazing. I wouldn't take it back. I really felt supported. I had the best you know, teachers and professors that really really helped me to just, you know, thrive and to succeed. I got a lot of really great opportunities. It was great.
Could you talk about the dumpster?
Ooh, yeah. Daniel has a favorite story.
Yeah, he always encourages me to tell this story. But so one thing about HBCUs is that they're typically in, you know, these like really like vacant and blighted areas. And so even though the school I went to was in the middle of Atlanta, it was in a more impoverished area of the city. You know, in the Atlanta University Center is the campus that I was a part of. Specifically, I went to Clark Atlanta University. But there's kind of an outer skirt of the campus, and that's where my dorm was. And so where I lived on campus really got a lot more of the kind of just normal, everyday Atlantan population that was there. And so one morning I got up, I had like an 8 a.m. math class or something. And as I walked out of my dorm room and was walking past the parking lot by the dorm, I just all of a sudden heard a baby just like screaming and crying. And I didn't understand, you know, this just made no sense to me. 8 a.m. college campus, where is the baby coming from? Why is it screaming, crying? So I just started to look around and figure out what was going on. And I noticed that there was in the dumpster, there was a young mother who had a stroller. The baby was in the stroller, and I watched her, in, you know, go into the dumpster and pull something out of the dumpster to feed her child, who was probably about 6 months old, if that, maybe one year old. So that really was impactful for me at that time. I was a journalism major, and I decided to change my trajectory in terms of my career and just really wanted to do something that could really change that circumstance for people.
What did you decide to pursue at that point? How did that really, that sounds like a horrifying moment. But how did that change, not just abstractly your idea about what you wanted to do, but what was the decision? What was going to allow you to do that?
Yeah, that was my first year in college. So that summer I came home and my aunt actually was at Swope Health Services. And so I interned in their outreach department. And I spent my summer driving around, going under bridges and serving the homeless population and just trying to understand what career field made sense for me. And I ultimately decided to go into psychology and later learned about community psychology and got my grad degree in community psychology.
You met Daniel at a conference.
Yep.
We'll hear Daniel's side later. Tell me about this.
Yeah, it was the Children's Defense Fund conference. We actually just a couple months ago met Angela Blackwell, who founded Policy Link, who was really kind of the one of the cornerstone organizations that put that conference together. So that was really nice. But I randomly met him in a hotel lobby. And and, you know, it was just kind of not at all, was there for a conference, not expecting that at all. But he, you know, randomly knew my name. And so, yeah, that's how it started.
Well, that is the music telling us there's a break. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is a portrait session with Ebony Edwards and her husband, Daniel. The couple's trying a novel approach to neighborhood development, urban reinvestment, whatever buzzwords you want to use there. They are using blood, sweat, tears, and patience from the resources on the East Side to hopefully bring about change rather than using lots of money to make things happen fast. This is also a love story. We'll hear Daniel's side of it in just a minute. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and this is a portrait session with Daniel and Ebony Edwards, a couple hoping to transform a plot of land, which they have purchased at 25th and Michigan. Their vision isn't for a building. It's for a whole neighborhood, and it's ambitious to the point that people across the country are watching. We just heard Ebony's backstory. Let's hear Daniel's. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
So tell me about your childhood, where you grew up, what it was like.
Yeah, I grew up off 35th and Prospect.
And yesterday I noticed you were wearing a ball cap that just said Prospect on it, so you're maybe a little proud of that.
Yeah, not posing. It's a real thing for me. I grew up off 35th and Prospect. We had a really strong family, and I want to send a big shout out to my family because they have been here since the beginning. But we lived in a neighborhood where my dad grew up across the street. My stepdad grew up across the street from my mom, and my grandpa lived next door to us. And so my grandmother was across the street. My grandpa was next door. My grandma was next door. And so growing up, I actually went across the East Side building homes with my grandpa, and really in the neighborhood that we're starting to build in. And so I had one of those baby hammers at 3 years old, and I would go to the material lumber yard with him, and I mean, that was just my life growing up. I didn't follow in the same path as my brother and sister because by then they had closed the neighborhood school down. And so I ended up going to Sweeney and Volker. And then my brother and sister, we all graduated from Lincoln. We all went 6th through 12th to graduate from Lincoln. And so it's funny because all my friends from high school, we would sit up on the fourth floor of Lincoln in the cafeteria and just look out and see all the vacant blocks. And be like, man, we should just come back and buy a block, and we should all just move back. And, you know.
So you had this dream for, like, the communal block that's sort of modeled on what your family did, but only with friends. You've had that dream for a long time, even if it was maybe kind of a joke at the time?
Yeah, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. Because now then you have to say, like, well, how do you actually build a block? That's a whole other story. So I went out to school. I got my degree in architectural engineering from Rolla, and I came back home, landed my dream job. And then
what was that?
I basically make buildings work on the computer. So I'm if people think about CAD and different things like that, but it's like more on steroids. So we manage and mitigate all risk from a 3D perspective before we even go break ground on the site.
So you were hired by someone to do that? Who do you work for?
Well, I work for myself now. Oh. Well, I guess I work for my wife. I don't get how this goes. Anyway, she's a CEO.
But so you landed your dream job doing that at the time for someone
else? At the time, correct. A major GC firm here in Kansas City. And then there was the crime lab project that was announced on 27th and Prospect. And, I did not know that it was announced on 27th and Prospect. I was just invited to that meeting to say like, hey, you should come to this meeting. There's this neighborhood thing going on about a new police station. When I got to the meeting, all the four city blocks of residents were told, hey, there's this thing called eminent domain and you have to leave. And that was the first.
And that was news to you.
Yeah, that was outrageous news to me because we grew up on 35th and Prospect. I still lived on 35th and Prospect.
And you were there as an employee?
I was at the company as an employee.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
the company did not make this announcement, but the city and whoever else made that announcement. And it was so, like, it pissed me off because the people there didn't even know how to say or pronounce eminent domain, nor did they know what it was, but it just happened to them. And it started to make me think, like, I called Ebony. We had just met July 22nd, 2012. So that happened in 2012. I know the date. She probably doesn't.
She's just smiling.
And I just said, like, this just can't happen to anybody again. And that kind of became my new career trajectory after that happened. So,
okay. So now we're going to back up to the love story because it's surfaced. Now the love story has met with the city planning, city passion story. You met at a conference. When you called her, was she like just someone you had met, or was there already something going on?
No, I call it strategic positioning.
Wow.
Some people might call it stalking. I call it strategic positioning. When we were in the registration line earlier that morning, the line was just taking forever. So I was like, why is it taking forever? So
why were you at this conference? I understand why someone studying community psychology was at a conference about the future of children, right? Mm-hmm. But you were an architectural engineer. What brought you to the conference?
Man, do you know how good it is to get away from work?
So
I was like really excited about that. And I had no idea like what I was even walking into, honestly.
Where was the conference?
It was in Cincinnati, but the conference did something unique that year. They tried out a new, it was like a program for youth organizing that was city led. And so they somehow found young adults, really, young adults at the city level to come to this conference together to train, actually. And so I had been selected from Chicago and Daniel had been selected from Kansas City.
And the conference is in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, Ohio. We rode the KC bus down. And shout out to Derek Purnell, who kind of invited me to that. But when I was standing in line at the registration, I saw that she had an 816 number. I looked over her shoulder and I was like, well, you didn't ride the Kansas City bus. Your name is Ebony. And I just didn't say anything. And then later that night.
So you're just filing away her area code and name from a form you've looked at over her shoulder. I will agree that this sounds a little like stalking, but I'm I do appreciate that there's some strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an engineer and I process stuff a little bit differently. So I'm like, information, data, information, cool, plug it in. So later that night, she was walking down the aisle while everybody was waiting on their hotel room. So I stood behind a column and just waited for her to walk past. And like, Ebony? And she said, yes. And I was like, you're from Kansas City, right? And she was like, yes. And I'm like, hey, I'm Dan. I was stalking you. And I handed her a business card.
I like your transparency.
I was. And now we have two little girls.
Okay, but wait. So I imagine this sort of like this romance. Okay, you know, like what was that? You've Got Mail, where it's like their passion for books is part of the romance. And I imagine kind of a similar thing where you're like, the passion is building over conversations about like density of neighborhoods. And
in some weird way, yes. I grew up with a really, my biological father was really... like he was really like militant, like a black militant. And so growing up, I didn't really care about black people issues because like it was kind of like forced into us so much at a young age. And not saying that I didn't care, but I just kind of was like, I'm gonna just go do my own thing and just it'll fix itself.
There's someone else being mad for you.
Yeah. Like there's plenty of people like that. So going to this conference was completely different for me. But it flipped the switch to say, like, wait, there are a lot of people out there that have injustice, regardless of what color that they are. And they just so happen to be like people of color have way more injustice going on with them than white folks. And that was like the first time where it was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll come back home and run for office. Maybe I'll do something. But our first conversations, like the first conversation we had, I was like, yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Did you guys talk about Kansas City at this conference? Where at that point, Daniel, you're an adult living in Kansas City, but Ebony, you had been living in Atlanta, then Chicago. You weren't you weren't here anymore, but were you guys talking about Kansas City?
Yeah, I mean, that because that's kind of what Daniel was leading into there, is that for some reason, even though I was in Chicago, I was like dreaming up ideas about programs that needed to exist in Kansas City. And even as I think about this now, it's just interesting. So it was a mentoring program, and I was having very specific examples of connecting youth and African-American youth who wanted to be, you know, in the creative industry, actually, to people in the actual creative industry that could facilitate the growth and development into a career path like that. And so I ended up talking to Daniel about this idea, and I was like, I have this great idea, but I'm not in Kansas City and I can't do it. I need someone to do it. You should do it. And that's basically how it started.
Yeah.
Did you like the assignment?
Well, it was my exact same assignment.
That you wanted to do.
That already. I wanted to do. I just didn't tell her that. So it wasn't like there was a little conflict earlier in our relationship. Ooh. To realize that we were not competing against each other as a couple, but we both had the exact, you know, really similar ideas, very different approaches to those ideas, but we're still going in the same direction. And so that's something, I mean, even resolves in our marriage today as we run this business. So mm-hmm.
Hold that thought. We are going to be coming right back. This is a portrait session with Daniel and Ebony Edwards on KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a portrait session with Daniel and Ebony Edwards. The couple has a big vision for a part of Kansas City's east side that's currently vacant. It's an area around 25th and Michigan, just east of Woodland, and their vision is something they're calling whole neighborhood transformation. Am I remembering that phrase correctly?
Whole neighborhood development. Close.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you remind me what that is, though?
Whole neighborhood development is just an approach that, instead of looking at single family houses only or commercial developments only, or just a single site development only, how do we take the whole neighborhood into consideration, and not just from the built space, but also from the people and identity of the community? And so we're just really trying to take a neighborhood scale approach to redevelop a community. So for us, this neighborhood once had 41,547 people in it up to 1948, and it had over 15,000 houses. It now has less than 6,000 people, and we have less than 3,000 houses that still are standing. So we've literally lost more than 89% of our population and housing stock. It's been demolished and everybody's left. So we said, well, how do we rebuild this whole neighborhood to make it whole once again, as opposed to just saying, well, let's just throw a couple houses in here and pick this site for a development. It's saying, well, who is the neighborhood? Who does it want to be when it grows up? And how do we do this?
The idea that transforming one building is sort of maybe a lost cause in some way, as far as the big picture goes. I wonder if that comes from, you know, we've mentioned or sort of alluded to that you guys got married in an abandoned building. And I wonder if your experience of fixing that building up to make it your wedding site was instructive in this way. So let's tell the story first and then hear what you might have learned from it. Can you tell the story of your wedding and where it was and why?
Yeah. So when I proposed to Ebony, I said, I know we're going to blow a bunch of money on this, but can we at least blow our money on a venue or a space that we can come to after? So we went to the Old Abandoned Workhouse Castle, worked with the owner on that project, and basically cleared out 47 tons of trash in 6 weeks and got married there. And then
I want to pause. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts about this?
Well, you know, as a soon to be bride, I had no idea that the male would actually want something out of the wedding. So at the time,
that's not the stereotype.
Yeah, exactly. Although I've been finding that's changing, but at the time I just wasn't expecting it. And, so I thought, well, that's actually pretty noble.
Would want something not Like for the whole city.
Yeah, exactly. I can get on board with that. That's an easy compromise there. Not a compromise at all. And we came back and, you know, actually did then kind of begin this process. I actually thought we were beginning a process of looking for a site, although I think that Daniel, this was like in his backpack pocket the whole time.
She was in Chicago, so I was like, I'm gonna just drive you around randomly and let's just look for random spaces. Oh, I got one.
So the idea was we'll find some place that we could put our resources into fixing, and then from here on out, like, the testament to our love is some place that has been transformed in Kansas City.
Right.
And so you landed on this building. Tell us a little bit about the building.
So the old abandoned workhouse castle on 20th and Vine, built as a third city prison. And it was the workhouse jail. So they had like a work your debt off type situation back in the old days. Built in 1897. And it's been empty since 1950s, 1960s, or something like that.
Now, I understand that you did have kind of a long-term hope that long-term your work would result in, like, some larger presence for this building. And what's happened with it?
Nothing, unfortunately. I think there may be plans for somebody to do something with it now, for the owner to come back and do something with it now. But even though nothing happened with the building, I think that we wanted to start a movement of basically saying, like, how do we...
You didn't buy the building. You didn't have any stake in it other than just, in the end, you'd be able to have your wedding here. And then it's in other people's hands whether they, like, use the fact that you've removed tons and tons and tons of debris from the inside, cleaned it up, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about the support that we got from it, but that was one of the biggest learning experiences in my life, because at that point in time, I was working for a corporate company. I had no idea even really what real estate development was on that level. So I didn't know the legal requirements that I needed to make in order to ensure that we had long-term access to the property. And so since then, I felt like we were screwed pretty badly on that through politics and a bunch of other stuff. I've learned how to kind of tighten up the ship around me. So contracts and everything like that moving forward. So it was a really big learning experience to make sure that not only we are protected, but the people who invest their time and energy and resources into supporting us are also protected as well. So
the owners of the building so this is on some level a similar arrangement with the daycare.
Correct.
Because you own the land where you're going to be building. You don't own the abandoned daycare that you're going to hopefully make into a co-working space.
Right, correct. So the big difference between this is that we've done no work on the daycare, but we do have a purchase contract in place and we're closing at the end of July. So we won't do anything with the property until we purchase the property, and all of this is in writing, as opposed to us just saying, like, hey, we'll just go start and just figure it out. And then
let's drag a couch out right now.
Yep.
So when you think about what you learned from this experience, does that feel romantic to you?
Romantic. I mean, yes, in a communal sense.
Explain that.
Yeah, because, I mean, people were just, like, really excited about the wedding, you know, and the idea, like, wanted to make sure that the wedding happened, you know.
But it's like you married Kansas City.
Yeah, because it's like really we go out now and they're like, it's Dan and Ann. We moved in the other day to a new place, and the neighbor walked up to us and she was like, hey, you guys, nice to – Dan? Ebony, are you at like Movement KC? And we're like, yes.
Yes. So people truly don't forget if they were a part of that. But just for example, like the day before the wedding, the Kansas City Parks and Recs brought out their trucks and their crews to like help get rid of the graffiti that was on the castle. And I mean, just like, you know, all of the people that were a part of it. I mean, really, there are more people that were a part of making sure our wedding happened than if we would have done it any other way. Right. So.
I also do. Right now, you live in a neighborhood up between now and when you move into your dream home and your dream neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You have moved into a place that's not as vacant as what you're building on, but semi-vacant, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
What's that been like? Is that also a learning experience, thinking about what's to come?
I don't know if that's... I mean, we're so used to being in neighborhoods like that because we grew up on the east side. So most of our neighborhoods are all like that on the east side.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a reflection of, like, now when we go into a neighborhood, it justifies our new business model of mm-hmm. saying, like, what is required in this neighborhood that we live in today is more than just housing stock or more than just commercial properties. It's a whole neighborhood development strategy that says, like, well, if we do this right, we should easily be able to pick up from Wendell Phillips and scale into the next neighborhood and easily pick up from that neighborhood and scale into the next neighborhood. So,
yeah. Yesterday you told me that the last 60 days have been crazy. And I'm curious what you mean by that. What's happened in the last 60 days?
Well, we went from building houses for our friends and family to getting the 2018 housing study that said that there's a 17,000 home deficit in Kansas City and no builders to actually build that, to getting invited out to Palo Alto for an Opportunity Zone Investor Summit in California and realizing that the need of blight and urban renewal is a nationwide problem. And we have really redeveloped our strategy, not only to address a friends and family type situation, but how do we rebuild every neighborhood that's been demolished by urban renewal across the country?
You're trying to basically write a playbook.
Right. And so that's been the last 60 to 90 days has been a major, like, mental shift of taking a business model from 5 to 6 units to 50 homes, 1,000 homes, 6,000 homes, 12,000 homes. The nation's largest home builder did 47,000 homes last year. The second one did 29,000 homes last year. So it's like our neighborhoods need housing to restabilize and owner-occupied housing to restabilize, not just more apartments and rentals.
And our neighborhoods, especially these neighborhoods, need more capacity to be able to create to be able to rebuild themselves.
Yeah.
So by us creating a playbook, it means that people like us who want to see their neighborhoods rebuilt can actually plug into something and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your goals are so big. I wonder what the sign would be for you, that something that you could look at and say, yeah, we did it. What would that be? What would be the, like, okay, I think we did it.
When the shovel goes in the ground in a few months.
The shovel going in the ground does it? That assessment from...
I think it does, because people have no idea all the work that goes into to even get a shovel in the ground. Mm-hmm. And for all of our homes to still be affordable for all of our buyers.
Yeah, I think that's good too. I mean, it may not seem like a lot, but actually there's so much demand. Like, you know, you mentioned earlier, we have so many people, even in Kansas City, outside of Kansas City, that just want to see the shovel in the ground. Like, they're interested in what we're doing. They want this to happen. If we can do that, then I think it's what we're talking about is easily accessible.
What do you mentioned that you have two little girls. What do you see as, like, the childhood they have in this neighborhood that you hope to build?
Oh, man. I can't. Like, I'm just hoping that my daughters are in the studio with, like, the next Michael Jackson or they're, like...
In the performance spaces.
Yeah, like, they're... Like, yeah, I was in the studio with them when I grew up. Like, of course I know them. Like, I
just want them to feel loved from any and everyone and to know that they have the ability to give that love as well.
And part of that is having a community?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And really making sure that every other kid outside of just our kids... have that same exact opportunity, mm-hmm. regardless of income levels or whatever. Like, everybody should have that.
Ebony Edwards, Danielle Edwards, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This show has been a portrait session, which means this story will be paired with photographic portraits of Danielle and Ebony by the talented Paul Andrews. We'll be publishing the whole thing this weekend at kcur.org, so be sure and check it out. You can see pictures of the Edwards couple in the part of town they've been talking about, kcur.org. And go to kcur.org/Central Standard to catch up on your listening over the weekend. Some highlights from the week include post-election analysis with John Eligo of the New York Times, a conversation about not drinking in Kansas City, and a chat with a wellness guru about self-care as self-discipline rather than self-indulgence. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Salisa Kalakal, Ann Knigendorf, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Paul Andrews is our portrait session partner. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Have a great weekend.